listening to the Business of Baking podcast with Michelle Green, the small business podcast that's all about successfully running your own sweet food company without losing your mind. If you've ever brought dessert to a party and been told you can make a fortune selling those, then you're in the right place. This is an honest, straight-talking podcast about the highs and lows of being in small business. Fueled by late nights, crazy client stories, and a permanent sugar high, we're going to listen, share, and learn our way to sweet business success. Here's your host, writer, speaker, recovering cake decorator, and incurable sweet tooth, Michelle Green.
Today on the podcast, I'm particularly excited to be chatting to a local health inspector who works in the United States. This is something that comes up a lot in the blog, the podcast, in everything I write. People have a lot of questions and are, frankly, a little bit afraid to get their kitchens registered, and I don't even know what that means. So I'm talking today to Jane. This is not her real name, but I feel like if she doesn't have a name, I'll feel a bit awkward. So we're giving her a name, and here's her bio that she wrote. And I think it's really interesting because she kind of crosses the boundaries between business and legal and all these things. So she's a local health inspector for a county health department in the United States. And she says, she says that she loved baking since she was a teenager and she's currently in her 30s. So I particularly like that because I feel like we think that health inspectors are like old people. I don't know why we think that, but they're not. They're kind of young and hip as well. So just recently she decided to dive into the cottage food industry because those laws are available in her state and they're not in every state. So we're going to talk about that stuff. So she gets to be a cake maker as well as a food inspector, which you'd think is kind of a crazy mixture, but it's not really. I mean, they are separate. One is her day job and one is her passion, but you know, the lines blur a little bit over there. So welcome, Jane, to the Business of Baking podcast. I'm super excited for you to be here because normally I interview, you know, cake celebrities or whatever, and they're awesome, but I feel like today's podcast is going to be super helpful for all of us out there who are just starting out in the biz. Now, we should say the disclaimer here for anybody listening is that she is not representing a health department. She's not offering legal or business advice. She's really just here to share her experience and her knowledge with us in the hopes that it helps some of us out there who are starting to undergo that process. When in doubt, you should always be contacting your local health department or your lawyer, if you've got one. So just make sure that you know that we do not say that this is actual legal or official advice. It's really just kind of sharing what Jane has lived through and how she thinks that we can help the rest of us out there. So hello, Jane.
Hello. Thanks, Michelle. So I'm also very excited to be here. It's funny what you said about the image of the health inspector, because I do work with primarily males, although I do, I have also worked with young female health inspectors. I do think sometimes people are surprised me when I walk into their restaurant. So feel free to cut me off if you want to change the topic, but one of the things that we've talked about is that sometimes when I go into a restaurant, so we'll talk about, I use restaurant and that really does mean bakery. It means a lot of things, and we can talk about that too. When I go in and do a food inspection, essentially, I'm always surprised that the people who have maybe run their business for 10 years or 15 years don't realize that there's laws surrounding what they do. So I usually ask them if they have the food code, if they know where to find the food code, and a lot of them do not. So they rely strongly on us and what we tell them. But really, I think that it's best that people know the regulations pertaining to the business that they do, because it is, there are actually laws, and there are pretty significant consequences in a lot of cases if you don't follow the laws. But that doesn't mean we're all bad people. So hopefully we'll get to talk more about different things.
So I think, yeah, we should establish straight up that you cannot just, for most states and most countries in the world, you need to actually find out if there are laws that apply to doing that work. In some places there are none, but in many places there are. And as you said, the consequences are pretty strong. And one of the things I find fascinating about this is that people often say to me, oh, I'm just selling to family and friends. Oh, it's just a hobby. But my definition of business is the exchange of money or goods for other money or goods. So the minute you're getting money, I don't care if it's from like your sister or your mom, that's a business. The minute you are selling anything to anyone out of your house, from a food inspector point of view, that's a food business, yeah?
Yeah, so it's really good that you brought that up, because a couple things crossed my mind. And the first thing is that something that we get a lot at the health department is that people will call for some reason. Maybe they're going to do an event, and their goal is that they want to check in with us to make sure it's okay that they're giving out cupcakes or something at an event. And they're surprised that we tell them that they actually need to get some sort of permit or license. And I can talk about the different kinds that I'm aware of where I live. Because from the health department's point of view, we actually view we view the money part a little differently. So there's a city, like our city will issue business licenses. They probably care more about if money's being exchanged. The health department cares about if food's being exchanged. And the way that we see it differently is if it's private or public. If you're ever serving food to the public, then you need to have something with us, and we can talk about the different things. And then in the event that, you know, you are selling to your family or friends, this is at least where I am, we actually wouldn't be too concerned because we don't regulate private things, but that's where a lot of lines get blurred, as if, you know, the lady who's walking around selling breakfast burritos or whatever, enchiladas. And it's like, yeah, these are all my family, but all of a sudden it's the restaurant next door and then the restaurant selling those breakfast burritos. And so, you know, sometimes people try to operate in the gray. And I think when you just try your best to follow the rules as best you can, it creates a lot less anxiety on your part, I find.
Yeah.
Do you think it would be a good time to talk about, I mean, I can talk about the different levels of licenses that would apply to.
Well, yeah. Can you explain to me? So we know that. So now we've established that obviously there are rules. Can you talk about what that means? Like, what does it mean to be legal? What does it mean to be registered in a really basic sense? What does that actually mean?
So hypothetically, you know, it's a good question. And honestly, I had to ask myself when we were talking about this, because it is very uncommon for a health department to like shut a restaurant down or come in and close you. But we can, especially if you're operating without a license and that's brought to our attention. I looked it up in our local code, which would be different. So each in the United States, each state has a statewide code, and then each county can have a local code as well, which kind of specifies some specific things to their county. And then I believe, which doesn't apply to me, if there was a city health department, they would also have their own set of regulations. But I live in a kind of small place. We just have a county health department.
I love it. Just to drive you crazy, there's three sets.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine if you had, I would think, I don't want to throw out anything that's false, but I would think like San Francisco probably has a San Francisco city health department.
Yeah, for sure, bigger places would have bigger structure like that.
And to try to, I don't want this whole thing to be intimidating, because really I do want most of it to be helpful, of course, but I did look into in our local code, it says that if you are operating without a license and it was brought to the health department's attention, you could be fined up to $500. And this does not happen often, but it also said that you were subject to up to 90 days of imprisonment. So I'm not interested in that. I can't think of any examples when that has happened, but I know that it's been brought up, and usually people get their licenses first.
Okay.
That.
So basically we're not talking about a license to operate. We're specifically referring, just to make it really very clear, we're specifically referring to a license to sell food, any kind of food, whatever that is. Interestingly, I have to tell you that I talk about registering kitchens a lot with a lot of people. People ask me this all the time. And so here in Australia, the way it works is we don't have state laws about this stuff. It goes by local municipality. Mm-hmm. And literally it's the kind of thing where I can live in my municipality and get inspected and it's all no problem. And the person in the next street over, it's not allowed. And then the person in the next street over, it's allowed, but you practically have to renovate your whole house to do it. So here it's very local. And I know in parts of Europe, they have the same issue as well. But when I speak to cake makers in particular, or cookie makers or whatever, they often say to me, why do I need to register? Nobody ever gets sick from eating cake. This is like a common misconception that people are like, nobody ever gets sick from making cake, or nobody ever gets sick from a cookie. You know, like even if a cookie's moldy, it's not going to kill you or whatever. And I'm always of the opinion that, you know what, health codes, health inspectors, health registrations, all those things, they're about protecting you as a business owner and protecting you as a consumer. And I think, would you want to go into any business selling whatever they're selling and not have, like, it's so funny to me that people think, oh, because it's cookies, must not be a big deal. And I'm kind of like, food is food. I don't want somebody with, like, tuberculosis or something handling my cookies, you know? So it's a funny thing that cake makers and cookie makers and cake pop people kind of think we're above the law. We're not above the law.
Well, and it is interesting because it's funny, you know, you brought up a couple funny points because there are plenty of foodborne illnesses that are transmissible just by touch. So like if I happen, the big one in the United States and maybe in Australia right now too is norovirus. And I was lucky enough to work in a place where a norovirus outbreak happened. And it's just because somebody walks into your establishment, or literally you could get it by touching a grocery cart or a ride at the fair. You have it on your hands. Maybe you wash them. Maybe you don't. Maybe you don't quite get it all off and you're touching your ready-to-eat product like cake or frosting. And all of a sudden, you have a foodborne illness that you're responsible for. And in all honesty, because of my kind of mixed experiences as a health inspector and also liking to bake, that terrifies me. I mean, I'm afraid that I would do that to somebody. And you brought up another good point too, which is that health inspectors work for public health. Like that's what we do. So specifically, at least where I am, and I think other places, we're usually hidden in the environmental health office of the health department. And we are public health people. So our goal is to protect the public. Another thing, and I don't know if we're ready to quite transition into it yet, but most people who are health inspectors are not in it for the money. It's not something that we get rich off of. It's because we want to protect public health. We have an interest in food safety. We actually get to have a lot of really good communication with a lot of operators. And so it's just funny how TV and things on Facebook about the health inspector and how terrible it is, I think it really affects the way people view us. And they always seem very surprised when it's just like, hey, I'm here to help you. You know, I'm just a cupcake maker or whatever. And so it's an interesting stigma around health inspectors.
It is, right? Like I've never been afraid of you guys, but people often are. I think they think they're going to get like caught out, you know, like, or that they're doing something wrong or whatever. So if somebody wants to find out, and we admittedly, we have said that this varies from state to state and location to location. If somebody wants to find out, how do I get a legal permit or if I even need one, where do they actually go to find that information?
So there's, you know, just because I am a local, like kind of like your, it sounds like your jurisdiction, however it works in Australia, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is contact your local health department. Health departments actually do a lot of stuff. So there's a whole other side. So you want to get to the, typically with us, it's the environmental health side. So I think that's probably fairly universal, but I'm not sure. But we also have like home visiting nurses and people who do vaccines. So you wouldn't want to talk to them about your food stuff. Make sure you get to the right person. So you'd look up, you know, wherever you live, Chicago County Local Health Department, something like that on Google. Yeah. And then you talk to whoever answers the phone and says, I want to open a cottage food business, or I want to work in a licensed kitchen, or I want to license my own kitchen. And hopefully they get you to the right person.
Yeah. For us, it's you contact, same thing. You contact your local council and you call the environmental protection. Environmental health. I think it's actually called environmental health.
So that's basically what we are. So that's good to know that it's similar.
I think the thing is you have to be brave enough to make the phone call. And that's something I want to talk about, is a lot of people have this thing in their head where they're like, if I call, then I'm going to get busted. If I call, I'm going to find out that I need to like renovate my entire kitchen. Or I think there's just so much fear around this process, which I've never understood, only because maybe because I'm a chef. And so I'm not afraid of this stuff because I've been around it, you know, for most of my adult career. I don't find it scary. So what advice would you give people who are actually afraid to even make that phone call because they're worried they're going to get busted or, you know, whatever. Like, what do we do? What do we tell those people who are like, Michelle, there's no way I'm calling because I can't even do that. I honestly have met so many people, or I have to say, they heard from a friend of a friend of a friend that you can't do it and it's not allowed and this, that, and the other. And so they don't want to call also because possibly they have misinformation. So what advice do we give those guys that are just kind of like terrified to call?
Just do it.
Just do it, right?
Just do it. I really do think that I totally understand the fear. And honestly, before I worked for the health department, when I you know, made cookies and did this or that, I was totally intimidated by the process. And fortunately, I get to work very closely with it. And the process that people go through with us, they have to go through a lot if they, you know, if they actually do have a shop in town, because they have to work with different offices. But in terms of getting a food license, which is of course very important, I actually think it's a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. And it's funny because even when people are going through what they need to do, they'll call and they'll ask a question. I'll say, oh, that just means you need to put a thermometer in the fridge. And they're like, oh, I thought it meant this crazy thing. And I'm like, no, you're overthinking it. Like it just means you're going to wash your hands. And so there is a lot of anxiety around the whole process. And I really think that if you just make the call, I mean, the worst thing that they can tell you is, you know, you shouldn't be doing that without a food license. They're not going to come after you for asking.
You guys are not the tax department, right? I mean, you guys are not the tax department.
No. I do have people actually sometimes those, you know, kind of I don't want to say anything that's not PC, but anti-health department people, they'll tell me about how upset they are with their taxes. And I just think, really? You think I have something to do with taxes? I don't, you know, like keep your refrigerated frosting cold, buddy, you know? So
no taxes here. It's all about the food. You know, the funny thing is like, I can't reiterate how as consumers, we would be worried if we went to a restaurant or a cafe or a bakery or whatever, and they weren't health inspected. And yet as business people, we somehow feel like we should be above the law or not follow those rules or whatever. But we as eaters of product would never accept that. So why do we kind of like think it's okay? And you know, funny what you said about the breakfast burritos thing. I know that in Texas, this is a really big issue. Because I'm not Texan, but I'm part of a Facebook Texas Cakers group, which is an amazing group, by the way. And they often talk about how people are like selling tamales out of the back of a truck or, you know, whatever. And there are some countries in the world where this is very much acceptable practice. I've got a girlfriend who lives in Malaysia, and it's not at all unusual that people buy their lunch out of the back of a car or whatever, and nobody bats an eyelid. That's just how it works. But certainly in the Western world, we need to be following the rules because the rules exist for a reason, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, we've had some interesting legislation that's gone on where people are pushing for things that would maybe, in the eyes of the health department, would kind of backtrack. But some good points were brought up of just the fact that we haven't had as many foodborne illnesses related to certain things. And that's because we have rules in place. And even if those rules seem silly and arbitrary and nitpicky, you know, I think as a collective thing of looking at the entire country and how things are regulated, we're the thing that I like to say, and I think this is super important, is that this may mean more to me than it means to other people. But going back to that public health thing, you know, there's so many. So we have tons and tons of foodborne illnesses every year. And then we have other diseases that are not preventable. Like you can't prevent certain diseases from happening. It's just the luck of the draw. Somebody ends up with this terrible thing and the doctors can try to help. Whereas foodborne illnesses, we know exactly how to prevent them. And people do die from them. I mean, small children die from getting foodborne illnesses. Elderly people die. pregnant women have miscarriages because of listeriosis, terrible things happen, and those are all totally preventable. And so in my mind, if we can do that, that's what we want to do. You know, we want to stop people from suffering. We want to stop when, and we also want to, we want to help the business owners so that they aren't tied to something like that, because it can be, you know, it can be the end. It can be financially terrible. I'm sure it's just an emotional process, but we want to help you not get involved in something like that.
I have an interesting perspective on that in particular, because I think I've only told this story a couple of times, but when I was, I'd not long after I'd opened my big store, and I went to the state fair and ended up with a case of food poisoning, which laid me flat for 3 or 4 weeks, because I didn't actually know that's what I had. And I went to my local doctor, and I'm like, oh, I went to the state fair, you know, yesterday, whatever, and I'm feeling really, really sick. And he did a whole bunch of samples, and it turned out that I had Giardia, which is like a common foodborne illness, right? And what I did not know, and I now know, is that he knew that I worked in food for a living. And in my state, there are requirements that if you as a doctor come across somebody who has that illness and works in food, you must actually report it to the food authorities. So literally like 2 days after I was diagnosed or whatever, I get this letter in the mail that's like, "Dear Michelle," from the health department or whatever, the authority, saying, "Dear Michelle, we noticed that you whatever, whatever, whatever. Please note you are not allowed to return to work until, I can't remember, it was something like 3 weeks or something after the date of diagnosis." And I like looked at this thing and I'm like, no. I run a business. Like, I can't even, whatever. But the letter was really clear. If you are found returning to work before this time, there are, I can't remember now, but it was like a fine or something. And so I literally, even though I felt well, I actually had to stay home, and I couldn't go into the bakery for like 3 weeks, you know? Or I remember like kind of, I would, so embarrassing. I remember I would like open the door and be like, "Hi girls, is everything okay?" And then like I'd shut the door, but I wouldn't cross the threshold. And the thing is, we, you know, that's the, I had no idea that it was like a reportable illness or whatever. And so as a business owner, I actually, my business really suffered from me actually being a victim of something that we as a business should be trying to prevent. So I got a really, I got an interesting perspective on that, because here I am going, oh my God, this is what actually happens when you, you know, you kind of get sick and whatever. And obviously I recovered and I was well and whatever, but it was hard. Like it was a big consequence for a day at the fair. Let me just quietly. So that leads me to this. What are, if you, let's say you make the phone call and you find out that there are rules you got to follow or whatever, but you find the rules all too hard, or it's like, I'm not going to hurt anyone. I love this, I'm not going to hurt anyone attitude. I don't obviously subscribe to that. So let's say you choose deliberately to not follow the laws. And so what are the consequences of choosing to go, I don't care what the laws are, I'm only selling burritos, who cares, and not doing it?
So that goes back to the thing we said, for 30 minutes ago about, if you operate without a license, that's the whole, you could be fined up to $500 and you could be subject to up to 90 days in imprisonment. And again, that is specific to our county, but I would think that each, you know, each jurisdiction would have something similar. And I live in a fairly small place, so I wouldn't be surprised if the consequences are bigger in bigger cities, whether it's more money or more, you know, jail time, unfortunately.
So here in Australia, there's been a recent, I don't know, wave, I don't know what you want to call it, of people, I don't know what you would call it in American English, but in Australian English, dubbing people in, like telling on them or whatever. Like,
like making a complaint. Yeah, or filing a complaint or something.
Right, or calling the health department and being like, "Hey, I just found out that so-and-so is selling something illegally down the street," or whatever. So I guess if that happens, like what's, like, does that happen in real life? I mean, I've heard lots of reports of it happening here, but do people actually call you and make complaints? And
oh yeah, we get tons of complaints. Maybe not specifically about that, but we do get that. We get like, the answer is yes. But I do want to point out too, kind of to tie in the whole non-scary health department, is that typically for us, what our steps would be, if somebody called in and said, "There's a food truck down the street that's, you know, probably their competition, the complainant, but there's a food truck down the street. I know they don't have a license, blah, 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 blah. So typically we would investigate all complaints, you know, unless they were just so small that there's no public health risk, but we usually investigate all complaints. So what we would do is typically go out to the unlicensed food truck, tell them that there was a complaint about them. Potentially, you can't really do an inspection if they don't have a license. But what we would typically do, the first step for us would be to just tell them how to get a license. If they were super resistant, then there would be a problem. But our first step would be to offer them the information of how the path to doing it right. We wouldn't just like, hey, boom. Usually the consequences come like way down the line if we can't work together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Lots of complaints.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the message you want to get across, that if you get told, you know, turned in or whatever it is, complained about, whatever, by somebody else, they're not going to like show up, you know, gun on hip and like shut you down. It doesn't work that way. They want to get you legal. They're not there to get you in. Like, your goal as health inspectors is not to get us in trouble. Your goal is to make sure we're just complying with the rules. That's it.
Well, and honestly, too, I mean, we don't like it. Like, we like, you know, we're people and we want the inspections to go smoothly and we want to have good inspections. And when somebody's super resistant and just really doesn't want to talk to us for whatever reason, they're having a bad day, you know, that wears on us. That's not what we want. We want to help people. And so all the stuff about, you know, controversial conversations is just, I'm sure in big cities and not all health inspectors the same, but every health inspector I have ever met has been somebody that I looked up to, that I was able to get knowledge from, that I enjoyed working with, and was usually kind of nervous, but also excited when they showed up because I knew that they would teach me something. But of course, anytime somebody potentially could tell you that you're doing something wrong, that's a little nerve-wracking, but it doesn't need to be.
So one of the difficulties, which we mentioned a little bit earlier that I wanted to come back to, is sometimes you read those codes and those things and they just like are not written in English. I guess technically they're written in English, but not any language that people would understand. And my thing has always been, well, if I don't get it, I'm just going to say, could you please clarify what this means? Yes. I'm often very, very strong about telling people to get things in writing, you know, get your health inspector to email you back and say, this means X or whatever. So I think a lot of the fear also comes from that, not just the people, but the paperwork is really daunting. Mm-hmm. I remember when I built my store, there was like all these things about paint. Like you had to use a certain kind of low porous paint, or I kind of remember now, or like washable paint or something. And I'm like, what does this mean in English? And I literally called the health department and I was like, or the environmental health guys. And I'm like, can you explain this paint thing to me? And they're like, oh yeah, you just can't use a brand that's matte or whatever. I had to use glossy or whatever. I was like, seriously? 4 pages to tell me to use glossy paint? What the heck? So I think we also need to know that just because we don't understand it, it's actually not a bad thing to just call and get clarification. They want you to pass. They want you to do the right thing. They're not trying deliberately to be difficult. So if you're listening to this going, but I read the health code for my county and I think it was all, you know, it just didn't, I couldn't understand any of it, just call and ask. Like, I feel like there are no stupid questions.
No, definitely not. I mean, we totally appreciate questions because, you know, anytime someone's asking a question, they're trying to do it right and they're reaching out to us before the inspection. The inspection is not necessarily the time to ask a big, you know, you could ask lots of questions during the inspection, but you don't want to have some, well, I decided to, you know, heat my refrigerated food at 60 degrees because that's what I thought you were supposed to do. You know, you want to ask those questions beforehand. We love questions. The food code, you know, when I first started, of course, my job requires me to read it and I'm a lot better at reading code now, but it wasn't always the case. You know, it is. It's a weird code. I just call it a codey language. And the stuff that applies to you is going to be scattered all around. It's not like you read one document and it says, this is how you open a bakery. And so questions in that respect are always appreciated. And the one tip I would have is when I first started reading the code, when I was in the food industry, not doing any of this stuff, I just use it as a reference. Like if it was like, oh, I'm wondering what this is. So then you go to the back and you look up hand washing and it's not there. And then you look up something else because that's not really intuitive either. But usually I was able to find what I was looking for. And then you go to the code and you read the code. And then if you don't understand the code, call the health department. That's what I would say.
Yeah, that's what I would try to read it first. And then if I really didn't get it, I'd be like, it's a phone call, you know? I mean, not to be cruel, but you guys are government employees. Usually your job is to answer questions. It's not like it's, you know what I mean? It's not like we're putting you out by asking you to do something. So, okay. So that brings me to, let's say we go, we approach our health department. Yeah, we do all the right things. And then comes the inspection. So can you walk me through what and obviously this will, your mileage will vary depending on where you are in the world, but can you give me like a basic walkthrough of an inspection? What's the process? Like what actually happens? I mean, do you guys show up with like a dark suit and glasses on with like a UV light looking for evidence or what?
No, you know, it's funny because I actually, somebody commented on my attire one day because I'm actually allowed to wear, you know, skirts in the summer and, you know, whatever. I can wear clothes that are not very typical of what you would quote unquote expect a health inspector to be. So I think people are kind of just like, who is this lady when I walk in? But anyways, I think we'll talk about the inspections. I think it is probably important to talk about the difference between like cottage food and some of that too, like cottage food versus working out of a licensed kitchen and making cakes versus having your own shop. Just because the reason I bring that up is because I want to make it clear that where I live, we don't do home inspections. And I can kind of talk more about that. We don't have licensed kitchens out of their home. And we do have cottage foods, but cottage foods are not inspected where I live.
Okay.
So I know that some places have, I'm licensed out of my home, which it sounds like happens a lot in Australia. And the health inspector comes and inspects my home and needs me to change stuff. I don't have that. I don't do that. But
I've heard from other people in the States that some states you apply for a cottage food license and nobody comes. Yeah. Some states you apply for it and somebody comes. So it really varies state to state which ones will actually inspect and which ones actually won't. So your mileage will vary on this part as well.
So my understanding of it from what I've kind of read about other states, because obviously my knowledge is limited, but my understanding of cottage food, we'll start at cottage food stuff because that's where I feel like a decent amount of people start out. So it's my understanding that some places, I was actually reading something about, I think it was Ohio last night, and somebody posted a link to Ohio standards for cottage food. And the way that it read, it actually appeared to me that you could sell the products, the typical products, you know, non-potentially hazardous, cupcakes, maybe you can use butter, maybe you can't, I don't know, you know, I do know, but that comes up a lot. So cottage food products, but in Ohio, it didn't seem like you had to register. So you could just do it and you had to label the products, but you didn't have to contact the local health department. Whereas where I live, you make the same products, you still have to label them, but you have to register with the health department before you can legally sell those items. But our cottage foods are never inspected. So you register with the health department as a one-time fee. Nobody ever comes out to your house unless you're linked to a foodborne illness outbreak, then the health inspector would have access to your house. Whereas it sounds like in other states, the health inspector does come out and do an initial inspection. So there really should be language in the code. So that's why it's always important. We're going to keep going back to contacting your local health department. And sometimes the cottage food is going to fall at the state level as well. So for me, when I was looking into the regulations for cottage food, I would go to the state public, you know, the state website, if you're in the state, and ours fortunately has a search bar. So I just search for cottage food and then up comes the regulations and those are actually a little more concise. Those are only a few pages, not a couple hundred pages. So
yay for concise, right?
Yeah, they're a little short, but I'm curious if we can talk a little bit more about cottage food, or we could move on to what I would consider the next step, which is if you work out of a licensed kitchen, but you don't actually have a storefront.
Okay, go with that.
Okay, so what I would consider a step above a cottage food, because, you know, I think cottage foods are a great thing because they allow people to do something that, at least for me, a couple years ago was not allowed. You were not allowed to make anything out of your home. And so this allows you to do that. It gives a little bit of freedom. But I think a lot of people feel limited by what you can do. They want to make, you know, buttercream frosting and cream cheese frosting and cream puffs and a lot of items that need to be refrigerated. And, you know, I hear a lot of like, the health department keeps telling me no. And the way that I like to rephrase it is that it's not that you can't do those things. It's just that you require a different type of license to do them. And that's when people are told that they need to work in a commercial kitchen.
Yeah.
So that would be the next step where you would be, you know, sometimes I guess we would call those people caterers. You know, for my wedding, we had a lady that did, she worked out of a licensed kitchen. She did catering, but she also made wedding cakes. She also made a ton of stuff. So under that license, you would basically have a retail food license, which is very similar to if you had your own storefront. You'd just be working out of a kitchen.
Right.
And then you're not limited. You can make food that need to be refrigerated. The amount you can sell is usually more. And typically those, so once you step into that realm, when you have a retail food license, then typically you're inspected, like you would be inspected before you open. And then depending on where you are, we try to inspect each license twice a year. Sometimes it's only once a year. And I'm sure other places differently, but we do come in, so we would meet you at your kitchen. Fortunately for those people, inspections are supposed to be unannounced, but if you're only in a kitchen, sometimes you have to set it up so you would know when we're going to be there most of the time, unless we just caught you by chance. So that's the next step. And then the other step, and we can talk about what the inspection would entail after the last step, which would be actually owning your storefront, and you would have basically that same retail food license. And we would do the same amount of inspections. You wouldn't be limited. And then you basically just have the storefront to have people be able to come in instead of having to deliver and meet on places. And hopefully that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And that's how it worked for me. I went from home to a commercial kitchen, and exactly that. I wasn't there every day. So the council would call me and say, hey, Michelle, we want to do an inspection this week. What days are you in there at work? That's exactly how it worked for me. I should just stop here for a second and say that if your local municipality, council, whatever, doesn't allow you to work from home, like don't just do it anyway. I know we've talked about this a lot, but I just feel it's really important. People just go, oh, I can't do it. And they're just like, okay, then my answer is I'm not going to follow the rules. And I'm like, you know what? That's not really the way to do it. I mean, these days there are incubator kitchens in almost every state, I imagine now. Yeah. An incubator kitchen, for those of you who don't know, is a licensed registered food premises, but you rent by the hour or by the day. So you, and often they'll give you options to like pay a little extra and store your stuff there. So there are incubator kitchens. There are a lot of registered kitchens that are unused. Scout halls, mm-hmm. church halls, school halls, mm-hmm. sometimes old age homes. Like there's actually the world, that funnily enough, the world is actually filled with a ton of kitchens that don't get used. And so I think the thing I want to just say before we go into what's involved in an inspection is that if you call and find out that you can't do it from home, please don't let that be the dream killer. Like, just look at it as something you have to get around, not something you need to just, this is the big stop button, you know? It might mean that it might cost you something to have to get out of home and do it at a different premises or whatever. But I so want to stress that the solution here is not to do things the dodgy way and just be like, yeah, well, they won't let me do it and it's their fault. Actually, it's your fault. And nobody's fault really, but as in your responsibility as a business owner to do things the right way. And just because the big dream to do it from home is not possible doesn't mean your business dream is not possible. It just might mean you have to go through somewhat different ways to do it. And if you're looking for an incubator kitchen, it's literally just a matter of Google incubator kitchen or starter kitchen in the city or the town that you live in. So I just want to stress that as much as I'm very grateful for this information and we hope that you all get to do your business dreams in the way that you want to do them, you know, please know that the no is not them telling you your dream sucks. The no is just them telling you that, you know, we don't allow that here, but there are other options. There are always other options, actually. So I've actually got a friend who started her cake business in a nightclub. I know that sounds really mad, okay? But there was a nightclub here in Melbourne that obviously was only open at night, right? Like 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. or whatever. And they used to offer like bar food and bar snacks and stuff. And so they had a commercial kitchen that was used only at night for the bar, where basically all they did was fry everything, right? And she would rent that kitchen during the daylight hours because nobody was ever in there. And so it worked out really well, right?
That's an excellent example, Michelle, because, you know, a couple of things came up when you were talking, and probably the most pertinent one is that one thing that I tell people in the United States, or at least what I'm familiar with, is that sometimes we call those kitchens either service kitchens or commissary kitchens. And Googling those names is definitely a good start. But what I also tell people is that we have certain places that advertises that. That's what they do. They're a commercial kitchen, and they rent out space, and they store your space, and they charge you however much money. But as long as any licensed kitchen that you can think of has the capacity to have someone else working in there, which I've actually yet to see it, like, you know, someone applies to say, I want to work at Joe's Barbecue. I haven't run into a case yet where we've said, sorry, no, they don't have enough space for you. So what I actually suggest to people is any restaurant that you can think of, you know, all the places in town, those are licensed kitchens, and you can put yourself out there and go walk in and say, hi, I want to make cupcakes, and I'm wondering if I can rent space out of your kitchen in the morning before you're here, or whatever. And a lot of times, I don't know personally, because I don't work out of a licensed kitchen, but I've known very young college students who put themselves out there, and they come back with their application and they say, I'm working out of this little place that's been here for 20 years that doesn't advertise as a service kitchen. And I think sometimes it ends up being cheaper for them that way.
It's often hugely cheaper.
I totally agree with the, you know, there are plenty of churches. I don't know if schools are usually pretty tight with stuff, but like, churches, community centers, senior centers, you know, they have kitchens and they're not used very much. So a lot of times they're definitely willing to talk to you about using the space. You know, whether or not that you like their prices, I don't know. But I think they're definitely a good place to start, as well as just, hey, I kind of get along with the guy or woman who operates this place. Maybe I'll ask her if I can use her space.
I knocked on a ton of doors and got access that way. No, I'm serious, because
I know
hotels as well. I mean, there are a lot of unused kitchens out there that people just don't, you know, and I have to say, I used to sublet my shop as well. So once I had my dream store, because I was like, I'm not using the kitchen now, and it's basically free money. And I think I used to charge like $150 a day or something, like something pretty cheap, really. And it worked. Like, it's free money for them. It's a cheap kitchen for you. You know, it really works. I mean, the only thing I'd say is that obviously you're using someone else's space, so you need to be respectful of that, and they need to be respectful of you. And you want to lock up your stuff or whatever, and obviously just take normal precautions. But basically, there are kitchens out there for the taking that most of us don't even think about. So
that is excellent advice. It could definitely be hard, I think, when there's a bunch of people working in one little space. There sometimes tends to be drama, but locking up your stuff, taking good care of your stuff, cleaning the kitchen that you're working in, you know, I think it's definitely a good way to get started. And I think it also encourages people, like the woman I know, you know, she works out of that commercial place, but she's really starting to think, well, I have to bring my stuff there all the time. I'd really like to have my own space. So it's a step, you know, you could stay there and do that forever, or you could take the next step and have your own place that you can lock the doors at night and let other people rent out to make money, or just, you know, it's your space. So it is an option, and I think it's a very good one.
So let's just go back to what we started a couple minutes ago, which, so now it's time for your inspection. Dun, 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 dun. Oh, I just encouraged the being scared part. Maybe I should be like, yeah. It's inspection day, part A. All right. So
no, then you'd just be crazy. we'd be like, no, you're too excited. Calm down, lady.
All right. So walk me through an inspection. What happens? The inspector walks down the road in their men in black outfit, and they walk in the door. And what is the process?
You know, so I've thought about this a little bit, because it's so routine for me now that I hardly even know what I do, but that's not true. So the first thing, you know, sometimes we forget, but I think that the first thing that the inspector should and most likely will do is show you their ID. I would encourage you to ask them for their ID if they do not show it to you. You don't have to, but I have heard of stories actually of people impersonating health inspectors and just pretending and going in the kitchen. So, you know, weird stuff happens. So if if you're concerned about the identity of someone who is saying that they're a health inspector, I would recommend that you ask for their ID. So I just want to slip this in here at this point too. It is at least where I am, it is a pretty significant, it's a very significant thing to deny a health inspector access into your facility. And that has actually come up a few times for us. So if if you're really busy and you're super stressed, a lot of times the health inspector can kind of slip around you and do stuff without bothering you, but you don't want to tell a health inspector that they can't come in. That's not a good thing. So I want to make that clear. So, okay. So once I've showed you my ID, you're like, okay, she really is the health inspector. I'm going to come in. The first thing I'm going to do, there's a couple of things I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be looking around. I'm also going to be talking to you, especially if I don't know you. One of the biggest parts of my job is trying to make a connection with the operator. So I'm actually like trying to connect with you most of the time. So I want to find something that we can talk about to make you less nervous. This is just me. Not everybody might do that. But so I'm going to be talking to you, trying to figure out, what do we have in common? What's going to make you feel better about this? Hey, I'm not really going to come in and close you down. Don't worry. It's okay. So as I'm talking to you, I'm going to wash my hands. In a retail food establishment here, there has to be a separate hand washing sink. And it is actually a requirement that that sink has to be stocked with hot water. And so this is per our code. So this could vary a little bit places, but the sink has to, during all hours of operation, have hot water, soap, paper towels, and a garbage can, and it can't be blocked. So we do see that a lot where people, it'll be next to their dish sink, so they'll pile dishes in there, they'll put sanitizer buckets in there, they'll put a ladder over it. And to us, hand washing is a huge deal, and it's extremely hard to get employees to do it. I know from working in restaurants most of my life. And so any little thing that's going to prevent an employee from washing their hands is a bad sign to us. So if you don't have soap, then we would be concerned. So any of those things, go ahead.
I'm only laughing because as a chef, I've seen all of this. Particularly where the hand washing sink is blocked by something. Mm-hmm. Like a pot of soup or like just stuff piled in there, whatever. I have seen all of that. It's hilarious.
Me too. And I feel like when I was managing a little place, I just felt like I literally had to hold someone's hand to get them to take a temperature or wash their hands. And it was just the biggest challenge was just monitoring employees' hand washing, which is silly. But I did find, though, however, that after a couple days of really harping on people to wash their hands, they could start doing it themselves. So it doesn't, hopefully if they're really not listening to you, then maybe they're not an employee forever. But so anyways, okay, so hand washing. We want to make sure you have hot water. It is a very big deal if you don't have water or if you don't have hot water. Those are two things that in some cases you could actually be shut down if you don't have water or don't have hot water. So it is actually a very good idea if you know something happened, your hot water heater exploded, they're working on the plumbing outside, you're not going to have water for 2 days or 3 hours. That would be a really good time to call the health department and say, hey, and this would apply to like power outages too, say, hey, something happened with our sewer, we don't have water, can we still operate, what should we do? And in most cases, we would work with you to figure out a plan. Like, are you able to, how are you going to wash hands? Do you have enough water for that? Can you boil water to get hot water? How are you going to wash dishes? If we can come up with a reasonable plan, then that would be okay. If we can't, then you might have to voluntarily shut down or do the right thing, basically. But you definitely want to have those things during the inspection. If we come in and you don't have water, don't have hot water, those are big deals. The next thing I would do, I usually start just by taking temperatures. So I wouldn't think of bakeries hold a lot of things hot, but we would check hot and cold temperatures. So I'll probably focus more on cold because that's what bakeries do. So your fridges just need to be below 41. So I would do that in two ways, three ways. Sometimes I look at the temperatures on the thermometers that are actually in the establishment. So some walk-in fridges have the little dial on the outside. It is a requirement where I am, if in your little prep coolers, to have a thermometer in each prep cooler. And I do think that's very important. I know they get knocked and they're lost all the time. I actually saw a really neat trick. I don't know if this helps anybody, but there's like stem thermometers that you can hang in the prep cooler, and then there's circle ones. And the circle one, I saw a place that zip tied it to the rack, and the more you banged it, it still stayed on there. And I thought, you are a genius. So the reason why it's really important to have a thermometer in your fridge where you can see it is that people get into the routine of things, and it's like, oh, I look at this fridge every day. I'm just baking my cupcakes. I'm busy. And they don't notice that their fridge went out. Or they don't have a thermometer. So maybe they think, oh, you know, something's off, but they don't have a thermometer. So they don't know. So they just ignore it. And then I come in and I say, oh, you know, your fridge is at 60. And I only come in here once or twice a year, you know, like, there's an issue here because somebody should be monitoring those temperatures. So the ways that I would usually uncover that, we do use like, we call them IR thermometers. Not all places do that, but the ones that measure the surface, the air temperature in the cooler. So I'll use that to get an idea. But the best way to know if your fridge is working is I'll actually temp your food with a probe thermometer. So you have a probe thermometer, digital thermometer, whatever, stem thermometer, clean it off with an alcohol wipe, temp your cream cheese frosting, and see what that's at. Ideally, it's at anywhere below 41, 40, 39. But if it's getting really high, there can be cases where we say, hey, you know, it's really hard. It's not fun for us, and it's not that common that we have to make you discard food, but we will ask people to voluntarily discard food, and usually people do. It doesn't happen that often, but I can't tell you, I mean, how many times I've walked into some places and the entire walk-in cooler is not working and nobody knew except for me. So it doesn't happen. A little trick I learned, you know, this is not, again, nothing I'm saying is like, this is all just me being a member of the community trying to help out. But a little trick I was told was that when you open the fridge, if you can smell food, like if you start to notice the smell of food, it's probably too warm. And I can't actually, I mean, I never, this is not like legitimate, but if I open a fridge and put my hand in it, I can usually tell if something's wrong. And I think the problem arises in that people just get so into their routines that they kind of almost become blinded to certain things. And I mean, everybody does. That's just how we operate, I guess.
I think so, that's human nature. When you see something every day, you don't really, you just don't notice it. It's just every day, whatever. You know, we become complacent only because we're running in and out, whatever. We're not really going, ooh, is that 3 degrees higher? Or, you know, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So we do all the temps. What about like storage, like things on the floor or flour bins or whatever?
Yeah. So a couple of things. And then we can also talk about, we test. Yeah. There's a few things I'm thinking of. So where I am, flour bins, if you have single ingredients like white flour, white sugar, brown sugar, whatever you have in your large bins, they just need to be labeled. So you just need to write on there. And a lot of people just do it in a pen. They just write what it is. And I do see unlabeled containers fairly often. And the issue, of course, is kind of just, you know, cross-contamination. You want to make sure that you're not actually accidentally putting gluten in something that you're calling gluten-free or things like that. The other thing that arises commonly, which is, I think this is interesting and good information to know, is that where I am in our code, the scoops that you store in your flour bin. So I used to think that you weren't allowed to store scoops in flour bins because I was always told don't put the ice scoop in the ice. I was always told that in restaurants. So where I am, it is actually technically okay to store a scoop in the flour, but if the handle of the scoop touches the flour, that is a cross-contamination issue and would be a violation. So in my mind, storing the scoops in the flour is just setting yourself up for failure. So most people just put them in, you know, I would call it like a crock, you know, any container that's just right outside. And that way you don't have to worry about the handle of the scoop touching the flour.
I'm trying to remember. We stored ours, yeah, in just like pushed into the top of the flour or the sugar or whatever. But I will say that I made it a point to wash them fairly regularly because they get kind of crusty, you know. So yeah. We are allowed to. I was allowed to store them in the actual bag, but that's actually that's a good one. What the heck? I love how it's like the handle is the problem. What?
I know. Well, you know, it's like because we look at so many places that do so much more than just baking. But anytime, you know, going back to norovirus or hypothetically, there could have been a bigger restaurant. The cook could have been touching chicken and then the handle and then the handles and the flour. So you never know what's on your hands. And another little tiny thing about flour bins, you would never imagine how much you could say about flour bins, right? But some people they'll just have a paper cup. They'll be like, oh, this paper cup, this can be my scoop. But that doesn't have a handle. And so your hand is touching the entire outside of the cup. And so that is all cross-contamination. So you also, not only going off of all of this, you want to have handles on whatever scoop you're using.
A lot of this stuff is really common sense, honestly.
Yeah.
It's like, don't be doing gross stuff. I feel like you could just take those like 400 pages of codes and just like boil it down to one line. Don't do gross things.
You know, I have worked with so many people in my life before this job that when I talk to a lot of people, they'll say, oh, what is this? What do I do for this? And I'm like, you know, for you, I think you're good. Just use your common sense. But you do those people, or we'll say prior, where it's just like, your common sense is not the same as my common sense. Like, I can't rely on common sense because you just expect somebody would know that they can't sell raw chickens out of their trunk, but, you know, they just don't know that sometimes.
So, right. Because they don't, I guess because they're like, well, I would eat it.
Yeah. Well, and you know what's funny? I thought about this earlier, too, is that what people say is you get some big place, been there forever, and that guy's like, you know, 50 years older than me and thinks he knows better than me. And you hear, well, I've never made anyone sick. I've been doing it this way for 20 years and I've never made anybody sick. And I just want to say, well, how would you know? Like, how would you know if you made someone sick? I mean, it's so hard to trace a foodborne illness that it's just, you know, it's like I could have, when I was a teenager, I could have baked cookies and made someone sick, but they might not have told me. So it's just silly.
Well, that's it. You can't, it's actually almost impossible to follow the trail. I mean, like when I told you I got sick at the fair, I have a pretty good idea of what it was, but can I really prove it without like lab tests? No. And by the time I realized I was sick, that batch of whatever was probably gone already. Like it's quite challenging to trace backwards in a restaurant situation, in a commercial food situation where something's packaged, it's a little bit easier because those things have batch numbers and stuff. But in your local bakery or restaurant, it's actually really hard to trace back. And there needs to be multiple people that got sick in order for there to be an investigation and stuff. So it's like a different story, you know?
It is. And I will say like one other thing I'm thinking about with the inspection, but in order to confirm, like to link a food to an illness, you know, when you're talking about yours, you might've been avoiding, I don't know, maybe you're avoiding the fact that doctors ask you to give a stool sample typically. And so when someone calls our office because they think they had a foodborne illness, we talk about poop a lot in our office. So I apologize. It's normal to me to talk about poop. So when somebody calls our office and says, I think I got sick from this thing I ate 5 minutes ago, which it is very rarely the last thing you ate, but that is a very common misconception. But it's, I ate here and this is what it was. So when you call and you had a foodborne illness, we'll talk to some of the nurses. There's a lot of HIPAA stuff. I don't know if that's an international thing, but privacy stuff relating to foodborne illness, because it is a medical thing at that point. But so the nurses will ask you about your food history and this and that, and they'll tell you, you have to go to the doctor and you have to give a stool sample so that they can test to see what bacteria is in your stool. So most people who had a concern about restaurant X, they end their complaint there. They don't want to go to the doctor and they don't want to give a stool sample. So that part never happens. And so even if that part did happen, like in your case, which I actually think is great because it's really important to track this stuff. And I'm not saying that you did that, but somehow they figured out what you had. So they would actually have to link the strain that was in your stool to the food. And like you said, that food isn't always available anymore. So it does happen where they're linked together, and those are like, you know, pretty big deals because it's so uncommon, but it is very hard to trace foodborne illnesses, unfortunately, but so many happen that we're able to do it.
For sure. Stool samples is how they figured out what I had. Well, because I thought I had food poisoning, but it was so violent that I was like, I don't think this is normal. Like, I think, I don't know, aliens have gotten to me or something. I went to the doctor, not because I was just throwing up a little bit or pooping a bit, but because I was violently, violently ill. And I'm like, there is something else going on here. Like, something else going on here. And yeah, there was a stool sample, and that's why he had to report it. And that's all that thing was. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, you're totally right. If I had just like thrown up once or had like a bit of a sore stomach once or whatever, I don't know that I would have done anything about it. I would have been like, oh, I just don't feel well. Like, I wouldn't have necessarily chalked it up to anything more than just, oh, I'm having an off day or whatever. So
yeah, I got the flu or a stomach bug or
It's not always hard to know when you've actually gotten ill from a food thing, you know. So the inspection, honestly, so let's say you find something wrong, right? I don't know, the hand sink isn't right or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do they get like a warning? Like what happens when you find stuff that's incorrect?
You know, it's a good question. I think, you know, technically speaking, I've actually worked for two different health departments, and they were actually surprisingly, in my opinion, different just in the way that they approach things. So same state, same statewide code, different local codes. So there are few differences that are legally in code between the different places, but the approach, in my opinion, was very different. And I think both worked very well. So I think the technical answer, and probably the only thing I should really say, is that as health inspectors, if we see a violation, we're pretty much required to document it, or should document it, if that makes sense. So if I just see that there's no soap, that should go on your report. If I just see that your flour bin's not labeled, that should go on your report. So if a health inspector came in and documented every little thing, they'd be doing their job, to be honest. And we can be held accountable for these things. So there is a little bit of responsibility on our end, because we don't want to not document something that we could get, you know, basically in trouble for. The one thing that I lean heavily on, which works, is that some places decide to do what we call risk-based inspections, which means that if we saw 10 violations, we would potentially list the top, I don't know, 4, because we want the person to focus on what we see as the most important. So it's not that we're necessarily like leaving off violations off the report, but sometimes, you know, if someone has 10 violations on their report, they might look at it and just go, oh man, this is too overwhelming. I can't fix all this stuff. I don't know what to do with this, and just meh, you know, burn the report, whatever. And so, you know, the place that I work currently, we do lean heavily on that. And so we will write the ones that are important. I personally, you know, I've moved around a lot, and so I just get to know people, and I really want to get to know people before I go in and kind of like really focus on the critical stuff. And so there's kind of a balance, because when you give someone a verbal like, hey, can you fix this? You're really expecting them to fix it. And a lot of times they don't. And so it's hard, because people will actually, you know, say they're going to do something and they don't. And so it's just this really, it's a balance for the inspector. And so what I do is that, you know, if it's something that's blatantly out, like, hey, your fridge was at 80 degrees and you should have known, then that's going to go on your report. And I'll get into something kind of important after I say the next thing. But if it's something that seems minor, there's no public, like not a huge public health risk, I might talk to you about it and say, hey, I'm going to be back in a few months. If this isn't fixed, then it's going to be a violation. And that's a very soft approach, to be honest. I mean, I know people who write every single thing down and they are perfectly in the right. But I have found that both approaches, whether it's document everything, focus on what you think is the most important, my personal opinion is that they actually both reach the same end goal. I mean, I don't see any difference in the quality of the restaurants and the places that I've worked. I mean, both places have actually really good operators, and they have two different approaches of health departments. So it's kind of interesting. I feel like the end result of different, I don't know, I want to say modalities, but then I might not be the right word, approach. You know, you take different approach, end result. So the one thing that I feel very strongly about, just because I'm kind of a nice person. You know, one of my favorite phrases is don't confuse my kindness for a weakness, because I do take my job very seriously. But so just because there's a violation on the report that sounds really scary, it doesn't have to be delivered in a scary manner. So a lot of times what I'll say to somebody is like, hey, you know, in order to do my job, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't document this on your report. This is what I saw. I write out in the comments like exactly what I saw, exactly what it should be, and how long it should be fixed in. I'll just say that, and I'll say, do you agree? Is that what you saw too? You know, nobody's ever said, no, that's not what you said, because I think I'm pretty good at capturing, you know, in words what happened. But just because there's a violation doesn't mean that the health inspector is going to like lay down a hammer. I think the only instance where, you know, a health inspector could potentially get like, you know, aggressive or riled up is if there's resistance and you're reacting like that, you know, because that's also human nature. If someone's coming back at you and fighting you on something, then it's the perfect person is going to stand there like, okay, this person's really upset and I don't want to be, but usually the really sticky situations come from when there's something I've thought a lot about before this conversation is just human psychology. And, you know, when two people meet on a, you know, it's like if one person has a bad day, the other person's having a bad day, and it just blows up into something. And so that also plays a role into inspections. I feel like I've gone off on a tangent.
No, I think it's true that aggression can sometimes breed defensiveness. And so if the people being inspected look at it as, you know what, they're here to help me make sure I'm doing the right thing. And if the inspector looks at it as, I'm here trying to help them do the right thing, that's a much better approach than like, oh, they're trying to catch me out and they're stealing my taxes and they're, you know, like, I think all of us just need to stop being so afraid of what these people who are just doing their job are going to find out. I think often when people are in authority, we have the same thing. A lot of people are like, oh, I hate the cops. Kind of, you know, it's like a funny thing. They're there to protect you. They're not there to purposely make you, you know, I don't want to jump into some like big political discussion, but overall, no, people who work as like firemen and police officers and, you know, whatever, are there to help you comply with the law and keep order in society. You know, like they're not there deliberately to find you doing the wrong thing. And if you're doing the wrong thing, you probably know it anyway, really.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's so funny because I am a, you know, I'm a regulator. I regulate the laws, but, and I have a lot of respect for police officers and I'm almost fascinated by what they do. But it was just the other day that I was having just a nice normal conversation with a police officer about something, and inside I'm just like, oh gosh, what am I doing wrong? He's gonna find me out, you know, like it's like, you know, you're driving along, you're not doing anything wrong, and you're just like, oh gosh, maybe my tail light's out. Have a little bit of, I guess you could call it advice that I thought of as we're talking, is that, you know, some people when I walk in are just extremely calm. I mean, they're like, oh yeah, come in. They're slammed, right? Like they're super busy. And I'm like, I'm really sorry, but I'm here and I can't really back out now. So, and they're like, it's fine, come on in. And basically what I think it comes down to with that level of calmness is that when you know you do everything right, there's nothing to worry about. I mean, it's like, you go to work, you check your fridge, you wash your hands, you set up a sanitizer bucket, your dish machine's working, you know that you do things right. And so when the inspector comes in, just remember, you do things right. And if there's anything that they can point out that you're maybe doing a little bit not quite to code, then they're just helping you. They're helping you identify things that you didn't see before. And I see quite a few people actually who have, especially now for me, people that know me are pretty calm when I come in. But I think just remind yourself, like, I do things right. I'm not trying to sneak the system. Hopefully, you know, hopefully you're not trying to sneak the system. The health inspector's here to help me. And if they do say something that you need to work on, then hopefully they deliver it in a nice manner. So
I'm actually so super grateful that we've had this conversation, because I feel like if we can just convince a couple of people to not be terrified of this process, that's a good thing. I just wish people would really understand. And I think the take-home message we want for everybody listening to this is, firstly, please take the steps to get legal and follow those steps. because that's what being a proper grown-up business person is about, is actually following the rules. So maybe we don't like those rules, but we're not above the law. And, you know, and there's a reason for that. It's protecting the public, and it's also protecting us as business owners. You know, if we do the wrong thing and don't get registered and somebody does get sick and then they sue us, right? Like, we're in trouble there too, right? It's not just about the county or whatever finding you. It's about the general public, you know? I mean, people do that. And in particularly litigious societies like the States, people sue food businesses for all kinds of things. Yeah. And so it's not just running scared of, you know, government agencies. It's also like, just do the right thing, man. It's not that hard. And it's scary. But honestly, once you go down the road, you don't have that to worry about. And we have enough in business to worry about than this. Like, this is the least of our issues. You know what I mean?
And once that does happen, if somebody were to sue you, it is so beyond the health department. And so sometimes the health department would be called into question, but it is, I do tell people, because there's certain things, like there's certain processes you have to document that don't necessarily have to do with bakeries. But I tell people, I said, you want to have this documented, because if somebody says I got sick from that item and you don't have it documented that you were doing this process right, then you've got a problem. And that's not something, you know, we don't come after you. It's the public that would come after you. And we don't want that for any of our operators, because we consider ourselves like a team, you know?
Yeah. And I also want to point out something really interesting, which is that this happens to me all the time. People book, I don't do this, I don't do one-on-one sessions anymore, but when I did, people used to book sessions with me and they're like, Michelle, I don't have enough orders. I need more customers, you know, usual kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I'd say, okay, well, what are you doing for marketing? And they'd be like, well, and like eventually I would drag out of them that they're not doing any marketing. And I'm like, well, why aren't you doing any marketing? And very often the answer was, well, because I haven't registered my kitchen. And I'm afraid that if I go and market, then somebody will find me out, kind of thing. And I don't mean to laugh. That's not funny, but I can't help you in that case. Like, no amount of, if I'm telling you, you need to market and you're like, I can't market because I'm illegal. Like, that's a problem.
I got to tell you something. So I don't know, we've gone on forever, but I don't care. So just cut me off whenever you want. But a lot of, like, at least where I live right now, there's a lot of, you know, we have the cake group, like I'm a member of your cake group. There's sites in town where you can like sell bikes, whatever, you know, community pages on Facebook where you can buy stuff. Right. So it's so funny because I'm pretty sure like, 4 out of 5 of the health inspectors in my office were on Facebook, and we're a part of those groups. And it's like, if something pops up on there, like, hey, I'm selling pies on the corner of 9th and Rose Street, you know, the next morning, all 4 of us will be like, hey, did you see what was on Facebook? You know, so it's like, we are members of the community too, you know, like we see this stuff. We like, I will advertise on Facebook. There's a lady that advertises on Facebook and she's a cottage food operator, and that's great and that's perfect. But it's just so funny to me when people, like the illegal ones that don't want to admit it, but they want to advertise on Facebook. It's like, no, you can't do that. You know, you can't sell cream pies.
I constantly tell people, if you are doing the wrong thing, do not be the person who hangs out their shingle publicly. And it's like, you might as well just wave a flag which says, I am doing the wrong thing here. And they're like, well, other people get away with it. Why should I invest in doing this? You know, why? Everybody else breaks the law. You should break the law. It doesn't make any sense to me. But I just love that from a business point of view, people come to me for marketing help. And I'm like, I can't give you any marketing help if you're terrified that you're going to get caught out. Because any suggestion I make, right, flyers, putting ads in papers, whatever, any suggestion I make, you're going to go like, I can't do that, Michelle, because then people will find me out. So it's very hard to remain not properly registered and want to grow your business. I mean, it's just those two things don't meet up, really.
Well, and to go a little deeper too, I mean, to me, like, this is kind of my thing for life, is like, when I'm doing something wrong, I have more anxiety about it. Like, I personally wouldn't have peace of mind if I was operating without a license. I just think, when are they going to come get me? I can't market on Facebook. Oh my gosh. Whereas when you know you're doing something right, and you don't have to worry about it.
I recently had a conversation with somebody who said, I know that I'm doing it illegally. And she she had an interesting perspective on it, actually. She said, I've put it out there. I've hung it out there. The day I get caught is the day I know it's time to move my business to the next level. And I kind of went, okay, well, I don't necessarily agree with that way of doing things, but she owned it. She just went, I know I'm doing the wrong thing and I don't have a problem with it. Someday something will happen to tell me that it's time to move on. And look, that was her way of dealing with it. I don't have a problem with it. But it was an interesting perspective because, like you said, most of the time when we're doing the wrong thing, we have that level of anxiety. She was like, nah, I'm just owning it. I'm like, okay, cool, you know. Thank you so much for chatting to me and everybody else today. I feel like we have given everybody loads of information, but the key takeaway here is please don't be afraid to do the right thing and please endeavor to do the right thing. If you're lucky enough to live somewhere where no laws or rules or whatever are required and you can just do it, that's great. But just remember that by doing the right thing, you are protecting your customers, who are the people who keep you in business, and you're protecting yourself so that you can continue to remain in business and grow your business into what you want to be. And that is not some scary, dodgy cupcakes out of the back of the truck operator. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are that you're somebody who's probably at a little bit of a different level anyway. You might have done the back of the car thing, but now you're ready to move on to the next thing. So if you're listening, the advice here is, do the right thing, make the phone call, ask the questions, and do what you can to become the proper business person that we know you are. Thank you so much for your time today. If I get any questions forwarded from this, which I probably will, I will send them on to you and we'll endeavor to get back to anybody who wants to know. In the interim, if you want more information about the blog, about the process, I'll actually put a couple of links for people to go and follow, because I believe there is a website, particularly for the US, to find out what state requirements are. I think there is a cottage food law website, so we'll put that on there. I'll put a couple of resources down there for you guys to read on the blog itself. At thebusinessofbaking.com. In the meantime, thank you so much for your time today. And hopefully this means that we take a few people off those crazy buy, sell, whatever groups and into the realm of actual business ownership. Yay!
I hope so. Yay!
Thanks so much for your time. And we'll catch you probably in a group. But nobody knows who you are. So just FYI, if you're in my Facebook group, you never know who's watching.
The hidden health inspector.
I've like put you in there deliberately. No, I'm kidding. I didn't know you were a health inspector
Thanks
until now. So that's
Business
it's actually super
podcast.
Useful to me. Thanks so much.
You can find show notes, links,
thanks so much,
and
everyone,
other
for listening
for
to the Business of Baking podcast. And we'll
at thebusinessofbaking.com. Until next time, may your oven stay evenly hot, your ganache never split, and may you always be in the business of being awesome.